Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with how much Mitt Romney has gotten away with in this election, having not released his tax returns, his list of bundlers, and not having spoken to the press for over 3 weeks at the close of a critical election. Alec McGillis, a senior editor at The New Republic, who is the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign, joins us. He has an article at The New Republic, Romney's Secrecy, Did He Get Away With It? Then we'll speak with Kenneth Davis, the best-selling author of Don't Know Much About History and the Don't Know Much About series of books. We will discuss his latest book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, and his article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning, which contradicts the conventional wisdom and political mantra, it's the economy, stupid. Then finally, with the cover of Business Week boldly stating it's global warming, stupid, we will look into the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of global warming with Cleo Pascal, the author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. We will discuss how much the U.S. is denying global warming while other powers are exploiting the new geostrategic landscape as the planet changes from global warming. Joining us now is Alec McGillis, a senior editor at The New Republic, serving as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for the Baltimore Sun. His latest article at The New Republic is Romney's Secrecy, Did He Get Away With It? Welcome to Background Briefing, Alec McGillis.
Glad to be back.
And it is a very disturbing to read your article in The New Republic, Romney's Secrecy, Did He Get Away With It? This, on top of the fact that Romney has not made himself available to the press for the last, longer than three weeks it's been now, hasn't it?
That's right. It's been, I think, 3 weeks and a day since he took any questions from reporters. It's rather extraordinary for someone who's maybe a few days from being elected president.
And we all have noticed the press shouting questions about FEMA at him, which he ignored. So combined with the fact that he hasn't been made himself available to the press for the last over 3 weeks and what you've written in your article, this is a fairly disturbing harbinger for what a Romney presidency could be. He might well treat it like, he's the CEO of the USA Incorporated, and he just delegates his statements via a vice president in charge of public affairs. And so we'll just get press releases. I mean, he's already set the stage and set the pattern with not releasing his tax return. So why shouldn't he get away with what he's getting away with in the campaign in a presidency?
That's a good question. I mean, he does seem to have a penchant for keeping things, playing his cards very close. We saw it even when he was governor of Massachusetts. He famously bought up the hard drives that his staff, for his staff's computers, when he left the state house in Massachusetts, bought them up and had them take them home with them, so that there would be no traces of his. Of his tenure on the hard drives in Boston, which is sort of an odd thing to have done. But then he took it a whole step further in this campaign with not just the tax records, but also his list of bundlers. These are the people who do your major fundraising and get all their associates and friends to give money. It's been completely standard practice for candidates to release the names of their bundlers. George Bush did it. John McCain did it. Barack Obama did it. Mitt Romney just announced this year that he would not do it. And so we have no idea who hundreds of people are who raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for him. It's quite striking.
And Alec McGillis, your article at The New Republic, Romney's Secrecy, Did He Get Away With It, begins with Newt Gingrich challenging him in the primaries about his tax returns, and that forced him to release just one, and then subsequent to that, he released a second one.
Right.
And basically, I guess the press traveling with him, have they just given up on trying to get the tax returns and the bundling list?
Well, they have. I mean, at some point, you just make yourself kind of tiresome if you keep pressing for it. I do think, though, that the press, not just the people traveling with him, they've got enough to do, but the press in general could have made a bigger deal out of this than they did. I mean, it's been weeks now since I've seen any kind of serious mention of his failure to release the Bundler list and the tax returns. It's almost as if he had done it and had gone away, but he didn't do it. It's pretty remarkable. You have someone who has a very, very complicated personal financial history, as we know, given the scale of his wealth and the kind of tax practices that we know he was engaged in, and all we have are the last 2 years of his returns. For all we know, there may have been. I mean, who knows why he's so reluctant to give up the more returns? But there is some speculation that, for instance, he may have. For all we know, he may have participated in the amnesty program that the IRS had a couple years ago to allow people with secret, unreported foreign accounts to bring money back without any kind of legal penalty. He may have participated in that. There are other questions about his huge retirement account and the trust fund he left for his sons and the sort of various ways that he managed to reduce taxes in a very big way on both of those areas. So, but we just don't know. And it's just kind of remarkable that he has managed to get through the campaign without releasing them. I was pretty sure that he was going to have to release more returns. Everyone, including all these Republicans, were urging him to do so. But he managed to get through without it.
And, of course, his huge retirement account is over $100 million, and his son's trust account is also, trust fund right. is over $100 million. So there's some serious money there, and there is, of course, the suspicion that the 2009 return would be the year that the IRS offered that amnesty program for right. Secret foreign bank accounts. So, you know, given the fact that his father started the tradition of presidents releasing all of their tax returns, and everybody, including McCain, did the stuff. In fact, Romney released his returns to McCain when he was being vetted for a possible VP. It is extraordinary, and you mentioned that the press sort of have given up. What can be done? I mean, do you think that there's this notion that in the court of public opinion, he will pay a price, but he seems to have made that calculation that it's better to pay the price than to release whatever it is that he doesn't want released.
Right. There's a real worry that he may have set a terrible precedent for the country, that future candidates will just say, look, if Mitt Romney didn't have to give up his taxes or a critical mass of taxes, why should I? If he got away without the giving up his bundlers, why should I? I think that the lesson we're going to take from this is really going to depend on the outcome next week. I think if Mitt Romney wins, it's very possible that he will have set these quite damaging precedents. If he doesn't win, then I think there will be, you know, a lot of people sort of trying to figure out why he didn't win, and I'm pretty sure that one of the theories will be that he was really hurt by this image that developed of him over the summer as someone with a problem with secrecy and a problem with, if you want to call it, sort of a plutocrat problem between his Bain Capital career and then all these questions about his taxes, and one can definitely make the case that his having withheld his taxes for so long and allowed all these questions to swirl up around them did hurt him at some level. He clearly just decided that damage that was caused by his not releasing them was worth it for him, because clearly something that was in those taxes that he thought was worse than the questions.
So, Alec McGillis, conversely, though, if he is elected, what does that say? I mean, does that say that the electorate has become cynical? Does it say that the electorate doesn't know the difference between voting for somebody on Dancing with the Stars or voting for the leader of the free world? I mean, what does it tell us about us?
Well, there are all sorts of reasons why he might win, and, you know, having to do with, you know, the state of the economy and some underperformance in certain areas by the president in his campaign, including that underwhelming first debate of his. But I think that as far as the tax returns go, I mean, I think this, if he does win, you'll have to look at this as I would say, as a failure by the press, and also a failure by the Obama campaign not to make a bigger issue out of it. I think that if the Obama campaign had pressed it more, pressed this issue more, that there would have been, that would have given the press in turn more reason to demand the returns. Again, whether that would have forced him to cough them up, who knows? But certainly, I think the Obama campaign could have made a bigger deal out of it. They decided not to, I think, because they also, I think, worried about seeming kind of whiny or even desperate. If they'd sort of kept it up, the drumbeat up about the tax returns these last few weeks, it might have not given off the most kind of the most confident vibe. But I just don't see it as any other way as lamentable at the end of the day, that we are about to have this election, and we just, there are these very basic questions about this one candidate and his sort of business slash personal financial past, and we just don't know a lot of these things about it, which is just kind of remarkable.
Well, Alec McGillis, it's pretty disturbing, though, to think that if Mitt Romney gets away with this, you know, and your point is well taken that the president may well have dropped the ball. I mean, he was given the most amazing gift to the Democrats were with that surreptitious tape where he mentioned the 47%. Right from the mouth of the candidate himself, you saw an enormous contempt for average Americans and unbridled arrogance. Now, you could maybe try to be fair and say, well, he was talking to a bunch of fat cats and maybe he was just pandering to them. But I think it's reasonable to assume that that was the real Romney speaking. So if you have a candidate who's already exhibited incredible arrogance and he doesn't believe that he owes the American people the kind of information that all other presidents before have provided them with, then you add the tax returns to that and the fact that on the campaign trail for the last 2 years, he's been pandering to the far right and the Tea Party people, making all kinds of promises. And then overnight, he basically made the calculation that, well, these people, you know, maybe they're stupid enough not to notice that I'm tacking to 180 degrees and now I'm courting the swing voters. So the question then arises, you know, is the guy lying to the Tea Party people or is he lying to the moderates? I don't get why the opposition, I mean, that's a standard question in British journalism, for example, when you ask a politician, you said X on Thursday and you said Y on Friday, were you lying on Thursday or are you lying on Friday? That's a standard question to a politician.
Right. And it's at such an entirely different level. It's been so dramatic and so ongoing with him that I think at some point it just becomes hard to even grasp it, the extent of the inconstancy. So at some point people just start to roll their eyes at it. And that was the real challenge for the Obama campaign, how to go after this. And they made a decision at the outset not to really cast Romney so much as a flip-flopper, because that would just maybe give assurance to swing voters that he would flip back to being a sort of Massachusetts moderate. Instead, they decided to cast him as conservative, but also as, and I think this is what the people often overlook, they cast him as sort of a 1% private equity plutocrat type who was out only for himself. And I think that they were actually quite effective at that, and the taxes were part of that over the summer, that and these quite devastating ads that they ran about his time at Bain Capital. And then the 47% played into that as well. If there's a critique that to make of the Obama campaign, though, I think it's whether they should have pressed that angle more in these last few weeks. I think that they kind of felt like they had done the job of on that front, and that they wanted to pull back from that a little bit in the last few weeks, so as not to seem too harsh or small at the end. But I do think he did pay a price for not giving up the tax returns. The question is whether he, at the end of the day, still kind of got away with something here. And you can't help but think that he did, because there's this information that we just don't know. And I should add, the bundlers are, I really think the bundlers are something he did not pay a price for. I mean, you'd barely hear anyone talking about the fact that he has not given up his list of bundlers. And this is just really important stuff. I mean, all these people who have played this huge role in raising money for him, for goodness knows what reasons and what motivations, and we just don't know. Whereas with Obama, you've seen good articles being written about various people raising money for him and the kind of connections or interests that they might have. And we just haven't been able to do that for Romney. We just don't know who these people are.
And, of course, that is part of the political DNA. The person who gives you money is the person who perhaps the candidate is going to do a favor for. And if it turns out that the person who's giving the candidate the money is a felon, for example, that's important information.
And I worry that future candidates will take this as a precedent, leave aside the tax return issue. I think that I don't see why any future candidate would agree to give up his list of bundlers when they've seen Mitt Romney not give it up and get away with not giving it up.
Again, I'm speaking with Alec MacGillis, senior editor at The New Republic, where he also serves as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. He has an article at The New Republic, Romney Secrecy, Did He Get Away With It? Now, Bloomberg News had a glimmering of a news story that shed some insight into the way that Romney used the Mormon Church to shelter some of his investment gains from taxes. Where's that story going?
Well, it kind of got lost in all the storm talk. It came out, just on Monday as the storm was dominating the news, and it was a good bit of reporting showing that this is a tax loophole that was used for a bunch of years by wealthy folks it's kind of complicated, but basically you would use your one of your favorite charities to shelter income, shelter investment gains for a certain number of years, and thereby reduce your capital gains tax bill. And it was outlawed, this loophole, but there was a grandfathering for people who already had money in these kind of arrangements. And Romney's had hundreds of thousands of dollars, apparently, with the Mormon Church, and has thereby reduced his tax bill. In the scale of things, it's not as big of a tax avoidance situation as some of the other things that he's managed to do. But again, we just don't know. There are all these other things like this that may be in these returns, and we just don't know.
Well, just in closing, Alec MacGillis, given that Mitt Romney has not made himself available to the press for over the last 3 weeks, that he still hasn't released his tax returns and he hasn't released his bundlers list, in these last couple of days, so many people have already voted. Is there any, we could make your article compulsory reading, Romney Secrecy, Did He Get Away With It? But the question remains, there's not much time, right?
Yeah, I think the important thing is for people to think of the broader point, too, which is that all the things that we don't know about his programs, his policies. I mean, that's the other part of this, is that I don't know if we've ever had a candidate who, in the last stage of the campaign, we just don't know. We don't know how he proposes, for instance, to balance the budget with these big tax cuts that he's proposing. We don't know he says he's going to close all sorts of loopholes and deductions to make up the lost revenue, but he won't say which ones. So that's just one example of we just do not know what he proposes to do in these major areas of domestic policy. We don't know how he says he's going to do away with Obamacare and replace it. We don't know what he'll replace it with. We don't know what he'll replace the Dodd-Frank law with. It's just quite remarkable. We just don't know.
And that has echoes, of course, Richard Nixon had his famous plan to get out of the Vietnam War, to end the Vietnam War. He kept saying,
right,
I've got a plan, but he never showed the plan, and it turned out that, in fact, he didn't end it, he protracted it. So there's an historical precedent
right there.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Alec MacGillis.
Yes, thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alec MacGillis, who's a senior editor at The New Republic, serving as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. His latest article at The New Republic is Romney Secrecy, Did He Get Away With It? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with an historian, the author of the Don't Know Much series of books. His latest book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidency, and he says the economy is not the key to incumbents winning.
That you really are, then you won't be laughing so hard. No, you won't be laughing.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Davis, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller Don't Know Much About History, which gave rise to the Don't Know Much About series on the Bible, mythology, the universe, and the Civil War, etc., that have sold over 4.7 million copies. A newly revised, updated, and expanded edition of Don't Know Much About History Anniversary Edition was recently released by HarperCollins. It now presents a complete survey of American history from before the arrival of Columbus in 1492 right through the events of the past decade from 9/11 through the election of Barack Obama in the first years of his administration. Dubbed the King of Knowing by Amazon.com, his latest book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. And he has an article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning. He also blogs at don'tknowmuch.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Davis.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And as they say in horse racing, they are entering the backstretch now.
That is true. And your latest book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. I mean, just following on from our previous conversation with Alec McGillis of the New Republic, we don't know a lot about this president who might be Mitt Romney. We don't know anything about his taxes. We don't know about anything about the people who've been giving him money. Is that unprecedented? Plus, he hasn't had hasn't spoken to the press for over 3 weeks. Is that unprecedented in American history to have a president who has managed to keep so much about who he is and what kind of money he has and who's giving him money from the American people?
Well, I two things come to mind immediately from very, very distant historical precedents. First of all, when Alexander Hamilton was arguing for the Constitution and the presidency back 225 years ago in the Federalist Papers, he talked about the presidency and what it should have. And he said the president needed to have vigor. And by that, he meant energy, dispatch, and secrecy. So when you go back to the framers, they weren't even that much afraid of secrecy. In fact, the presidency was created in secret when we go to Philadelphia and the convention in 1787. But we've come a long way since then, obviously, and everything that's happened in history since then has been much more transparency than less, although the other interesting precedent that comes immediately to mind is the fact that many Americans did not know that Franklin D. Roosevelt was in a wheelchair when he was elected four times. There were only three photographs known that the FDR Library knows of showing Roosevelt in a wheelchair. So we have a history of keeping some things secret. Obviously, the secrets of some presidents and their private lives has been secret. But, you know, since the Watergate years, we've really gone to a much more openness, certainly when it comes to candidates and their finances. Certainly Mr. Romney's reluctance or refusal to introduce some of his tax returns is relatively unprecedented in recent times.
So, Kenneth Davis, your article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning, what you say here is that starting with George Washington's 1792 re-election, 19 incumbents have been returned to office, while another 8 were either denied the nomination or chose not to run. 5 presidents died during their first term. That leaves 10 first-term presidents who lost their re-election bids. Just take us through those 10 to give a sense of where we stand today with the possible re-election of Barack Obama.
Absolutely. And first of all, I would say that one thing that certainly seems to suggest is incumbency is obviously a powerful thing. And we've witnessed that, I think, in the past a few days as we've seen the president responding to a crisis and Mr. Romney, you know, clearly pushed to the sidelines of the media and in some cases perhaps even mocked for his efforts. And so that's what the power of incumbency means. But if you go through those 10, and I list them each in the CNN.com piece I wrote, you can only really point to 4 where the economy was clearly the issue. You know, the famous Bill Clinton saying, the war room saying, it's the economy, stupid. But it isn't always, if you look at history. The 4 I point to specifically, Martin Van Buren, the 8th president, who was one of the first incumbents who lost office, really only because of the economy, the Panic of 1837, it was called, our version of a depression. It was long, it was deep, it lasted a long time. Most Americans don't realize that depressions were quite common in the 19th century. There were many of them. They called them panics back then as opposed to the depression. But Van Buren was mocked as Martin Van Ruin. He was castigated as being not interested in the average person, that he was a lavish spender and that he was a dandy. So there was an element of presenting him and depicting him as an elitist as well. So it's always been that part of the campaign as well. And then, of course, Herbert Hoover, done in clearly by the Great Depression, loses the election in a landslide to Franklin D. Roosevelt. More recently, Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush were clearly the victims of the economy. But even there, I think you have to say that there are other factors involved. Going back earlier time among those 10, I point to the first 2 presidents to serve as one-term presidents, with John Adams and John Quincy Adams. And again, there it's not a matter of there being a terrible economic crisis, but these were men who were able to be painted as by their opponents as out of touch, as elitist, as not man of the people idea. And so that part of politics has always played into the election of the incumbent. I think you also look on the other side when you have incumbents who have been elected in spite of a very bad economy. And again, Franklin D. Roosevelt is the first example there. When he was reelected in 1936, the economy was still what we would call a basket case in modern terms.
Again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Davis, the author of the New York Times bestseller Don't Know Much About History, which gave rise to the Don't Know Much About series on the Bible, mythology, the universe, and Civil War, etc. His latest book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, and he has an article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning, and he also blogs at don'tknowmuch.com. So this is clearly would be music to the Obama campaign's ears, given how much we have bought into the James Carville, Bill Clinton notion of it's the economy, stupid. What other factors do you think are at play in this particular election that have some echoes of history? Because, you know, in terms of a couple of the people that you mentioned, George H.W. Bush, you know, the role of Ross Perot there, William Howard Taft, the role of the Bull Moose candidate, who, of course, made himself a lame duck when he got reelected by saying he wouldn't run for a third term, and he tried to make up for it, Teddy Roosevelt. Obama's had a pretty easy run, hasn't he? He's had no primary challenges. There are the third party people, the Greens and the Libertarians, are polling at about 2% of the electorate. We could have another Florida situation if it gets too tight, but by and large, none of those factors have impacted Obama. So how do you assess him in terms of a presidential candidate? Has he been relatively lucky?
Well, I would say so. In yes, in the sense of some of those you mentioned. First of all, one of the most fascinating campaigns in American history, 100 years ago. You referenced it, 1912, Taft versus Roosevelt versus Woodrow Wilson, and throw Eugene V. Debs in there for good measure. It was quite an extraordinary year, and this was the time at which Taft was the incumbent. He had been Roosevelt's successor. Roosevelt then went off to safari in Africa, came back and decided that Taft wasn't quite up to the job and decided to run again. Lost the nomination in the Republican convention, stormed out angrily, and started his own party, the Progressives or Bull Moose. He then went on to become the most successful third party candidate in history. But because he and Taft split the vote, it really helped Woodrow Wilson to victory. By the way, they said back in those days that Taft, T-A-F-T, meant take advice from Theodore. Not a happy thing to be able to have to run against the image of your predecessor. You mentioned also Ross Perot, and that's a crucial one in 1992, as well as Ralph Nader in 2000. And third-party candidates have always filled this role in American history, with the exception of Roosevelt. They've almost always been spoilers who never really had a chance themselves. And that goes back to the very early days of American history. So yes, Mr. Obama did not have a challenger from another wing of his party in the nomination process. He doesn't have a major third party candidate. Although there's always something fluky that can happen. Elections are very, very strange things until they play out completely. So, yes, absolutely, he's been lucky in that sense.
But surely, Kenneth Davis, one of the things that's changed over the years and will affect this race is the unprecedented amount of money pouring in. It's going to be a $6 billion election, and Citizens United's Supreme Court decision have opened the floodgates, clearly, and so much of the money is unattributed. In fact, we have a paradox where there's a lot of voter suppression going on, demanding registered voters and people who voted before to prove who they are. And conversely, people who are funding Mitt Romney in large part don't have to identify who they are. So maybe there are echoes of the first Gilded Age in this, but we have a totally different media environment today with so much different and new media that I'm wondering whether the whole process has been somewhat trivialized, with the news becoming more like infotainment, and how much of the population nowadays see an election as a way that they see, for example, voting on Dancing with the Stars. You know, you're not necessarily voting for the leader of the free world. You're voting for whoever you happen to like at that moment.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that you've raised a whole host of really important issues that I think are on the table this year, Ian, especially with the Citizens United decision, and an awful lot of people on both sides are really concerned about this tremendous flood of money coming in, unrestricted, unregulated. Of course, those of us who remember Watergate and Richard Nixon, and that it all started with campaign slush funds and unregulated money, and that was the real true beginnings of the Federal Election Commission to begin to regulate that. But historically, it's always been part of the game. It's just that the stakes have gone up, as you said. But again, Theodore Roosevelt really complained about this back in 1912. He thought that the wealthiest of Americans were essentially buying the election. So it's always been a theme in presidential history, but it's really become so much more exaggerated because of television primarily and the great costs involved in television advertising. And it's interesting to see, for instance, about a week or so ago, I saw a piece that suggested that even members of the GOP who had in Congress, who had always resisted any calls for campaign finance reform, were getting scared by this because they were seeing that these nameless super PACs could now turn their sights on them. And so it's always going to come out of that sense of self-interest, I think, that makes some change. And clearly, many, many people are upset with this. The fear I have, of course, is that this just turns off more voters. We already have a pretty pathetic record when it comes to not only presidential election involvement, but in the other years. And I think that this corrosive effect of all these big dollars and the advertising, which many, many people are really feel has gone way, way too far, might really be getting to a tipping point. So will we see some meaningful reform in this country? I'm not terribly optimistic about it, but I certainly hope so. Interesting small point, on the other hand, is that someone recently suggested that most of the money goes to the person who eventually wins. Now, in a sense that the money flows where the likely winner is going to be, not necessarily what they want to see. So that's an interesting aspect to this. I'm not sure it changes the basic debate, though.
Well, just in closing then, Kenneth Davis, you mentioned the wild cards, and of course the wild card in terms of Theodore Roosevelt was that he wasn't supposed to even be elected. He was the vice president. He put on there to balance the ticket against the choice of the plutocrats, and then lo and behold, McKinley gets shot, and the worst nightmare of the plutocrats ends up becoming the president. So any wild cards in this election?
Well, there are always the talk of the October surprise. I think we've had a small but significant one here today on the East Coast in Mayor Bloomberg issuing a very surprising 11th hour endorsement of Barack Obama on the pages of the Bloomberg newspaper. Of course, Mayor Bloomberg, mayor of New York City, and he's really tipping that decision to the question of climate change, which neither candidate had been addressing at all. So an issue that had not been on the table at all through almost all of this campaign is suddenly a fairly significant one when it comes to the endorsement of Mayor Bloomberg, which was highly sought by both candidates. So there are always surprises, and we don't know, for instance, what this storm is going to mean in terms of the final result. I'm sure it will have some impact. Maybe you're not feeling it there on the West Coast, but here in the East, it's kind of all we're thinking about.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kenneth Davis.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's a great pleasure to be with you, and thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Davis, the author of the New York Times bestseller Don't Know Much About History, which gave rise to the Don't Know Much About series on the Bible, mythology, the universe, the Civil War, etc., that have sold over 4.7 million copies. He has been dubbed the King of Knowing by Amazon.com, and his latest book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, and he has an article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning. He blogs at don'tknowmuch.com. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about not just how much global warming is affecting New York and New Jersey, but how it's changing the geopolitics of the earth.
Watching the ships roll in, and then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And she is one of the three recipients of the 2010 Awards for Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her latest book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And you have spent a lot of time with these small Pacific Island nations that are being swamped by the rising ocean due to global warming. And given what just happened on the northeast coast with New Jersey and New York taking this huge hit from the superstorm Sandy, it's beginning to look like New York is also Tuvalu.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are some places all around the world, including in the U.S., that are going to have to undergo some form of very difficult urban triage where a decision is just made, look, this isn't going to work. We continue to put people in harm's way, critical infrastructure in harm's way. I'm not sure the entire island of Manhattan would need to be abandoned unless you get into the kind of some of the more extreme scenarios. But certainly the southern part of the island, which is largely reclaimed and very low-lying, and a lot of the entries into the bridges and the tunnels and the subway systems will all have to be seriously rethought. And hopefully that'll be done through changes to, you know, insurance and zoning regulations, things that just make it financially not viable to be in those places in the first place.
So are we talking about New York being like New Orleans? Because New Orleans, the Army Corps of Engineers have spent billions there, and they just had another hurricane, and some of the levees were breached. So
yeah, they're different geophysical environments. So New Orleans is in a delta, and it's rapidly subsiding, and it's in a hurricane, strong hurricane pathway. New York is the actual island of New York is a little bit more solid, and it's not a delta region. But once the water gets high enough and it overtops, as we can see, it gets right into the massive underground infrastructure of the city, including the subway systems, the electrical lines, that sort of thing. So there, for different reasons, we're kind of coming to the same result, which is that we really need to rethink where we're incentivizing people to live and work.
Well, you would think, though, that the people in New York, and particularly on Wall Street, the titans who, you know, the economy's become more and more financialized, and these are the people, not just those that dominate the American economy, but they're the masters of the universe in terms of the global economy, and they want to live in New York, and they just got their toes wet from the water in the Battery right next door to Wall Street. And the current issue of Business Week has front page cover story is, it's global warming, stupid. So what's your sense of whether the 1% will want to weigh in and make global warming real and, I guess, in the process, build dikes around Wall Street?
I think there's a real incredible ability of the human mind to rationalize. You'll start very soon. You'll start to see people saying, you know, this is a one-off event, forgetting that Irene gave a little taste of what was going to happen last year, and we're likely to see more events going forward. The very top of the food chain is going to say to themselves that they can buy their way out of this problem. The thing is that they're, you know, they're at the top of a pyramid, and as the entire pyramid gets undermined and corroded, all of the other financial sectors that are supporting them at the top start to become increasingly unstable, not just in the U.S. but globally. They will definitely be affected. There's no two ways around it. Building dikes around or seawalls around Manhattan is quite complicated given the geography of the area. It's not totally out of the realm of possibility, but it would take major multi-billion-dollar federal-level investment in that project at a time when the government is already quite broke. And, of course, one of the minor reasons that they're broke is the National Flood Insurance Program, which has insured all of these locations that are completely unviable over the long run. The government is telling you it's okay to live in these areas when it's really not okay to live in these areas. And a change in programs like those might actually be a real motivator for a change in behavior of those at the top, because the cost of living in those areas would go up tremendously.
Now, you're in London, and in the Thames, there are these floodgates that are supposed to stop a tidal surge, as what happened in New York with, I think, a 14-foot, I think it eventually came, the surge, you know, swamping so much of New York and New Jersey. So how realistic would it be to put floodgates in the Hudson?
Well, it's possible, but I'm not sure whether that would be a complete defense or not, because the sort of events that we're seeing are multi-combination. They're very complex events. So it's not just river flooding or just storm surge. As we saw, we had, you know, a very strong storm coming in from the ocean at the same time as we had a cold front coming down, and we had full moon and myriad factors coming into play at the same time. So it would be, you know, fine to put up something on the Hudson, but if you're not also protecting from the seaside, then it's a rather incomplete defense. What's needed is a rounded analysis of vulnerabilities and a comprehensive solution offered. And if there is no comprehensive solution, a facing up to that reality and a decision about what to do next.
So turning to your book, Claire Pascal, Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. And as I mentioned, you spent a lot of time on the Pacific Islands, nations that are being threatened with extinction by the rising oceans from global warming. There's a lot of jockeying going on in the Arctic as a result of the unprecedented melting of the Arctic ice caps, and Russia and Canada and other countries are getting into the act in terms of claiming territory for navigation rights as well as mineral rights. What is your sense of how much the rest of the world seems to have accepted the reality of global warming and are in fact hedging and preparing for it, while the United States, we have one political party, the Republican Party, its official policy, if you will, is to deny global warming. And, you know, the public may well be ahead of them. And neither president really talked anything about it in these debates. So the impression I get is that the rest of the world is trying to adapt or even exploit global warming, and we're just having nonsensical, anti-scientific debates here in the United States.
I think you're absolutely right. It's an unnecessarily tragic situation. China, for example, did its Arctic projections and realized this is opening up as a very important area, not just in terms of shipping routes and resources, as you mentioned, but also geostrategically in terms of getting in, you know, listening devices and various other sorts of dual-use potential equipment. So in China is now a proto-Arctic power. It has one icebreaker and others on the way. It's moving for observer status at the Arctic Council. It's heavily courting individual Arctic nations. There's talk of shipping in around 2,000 Chinese workers to set up an aluminum plant in Greenland, which would have a huge social effect in Greenland. There's a projected 2 to 3 million Chinese working in Siberia, gaining Arctic experience there. There's all over in many different aspects of economics and politics. You can see China acknowledging that these changes are happening and positioning itself to take advantage of them in a very calculated, intelligent but cool-headed way. While we're still kind of bickering over, you know, whether this was a one-off event or not, which, as we know, it wasn't, because we had Irene last year, and this is going to be happening increasingly in the future.
So given that these other nations like China, Russia, and Canada are hedging and prepared to exploit geostrategic changes as a result of global warming, and the U.S. is lagging there, that's sort of depressing in a way, because this is basically accepting the inevitable rather than focusing on what we can do to prevent what may be exploitable but is a catastrophe.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I would much prefer for us all to be saying, okay, look, this is happening, and we need to start looking for solutions of myriad sorts, you know, not just, let's see if we can get more oil out of the Arctic. By the way, it's worth noticing or remarking on the disconnect within the political parties in the U.S. on this denial of climate change. Because, for example, the Republicans may say there's no global warming, but then they will also say, and we're going to go into the opening Arctic and get more energy resources. Well, if the Arctic wasn't opening, how could you go and get more energy resources? What do you think is causing the opening of the Arctic in the first place? So there's sort of a pick-and-choose approach to looking at the issue that is very, very detrimental towards not even long-term, not even medium-term, but short-term positioning and survival in a dramatically changing geopolitical and geoeconomic environment.
Well, maybe God has heard the drill, baby, drill mantra.
That's right. So God is kind of hovering over the Arctic with a blow dryer, just sort of affecting that one region alone.
Right. Yeah. So just to touch on, as you have on American domestic politics in the last few days of this election, Mitt Romney has made a big pitch for North American energy independence, and a lot of that depends upon exploiting the Canadian tar sands and building the pipelines, the Keystone pipelines. You're a Canadian. So how do you feel about the idea of us all joining together in exploiting some of the most carbon-intensive energy sources? And, of course, Mitt Romney's tied in with big coal. So if he's elected, we're going to go the opposite direction of doing anything about global warming. We will be pumping CO2 over time.
Yeah, I think that there is a real fallacy in the Keystone discussion. I can't see U.S. oil companies. I mean, it's acknowledged that U.S. oil companies are a relatively influential lobby, but U.S. oil companies don't just operate in the U.S. They operate elsewhere as well. And so I'm not so sure they're going to want to see their revenues drop in terms of imports from oil from Nigeria or Iraq or wherever into the U.S. So there's a very strong lobby within that group that does not want the U.S. to be energy independent, which is why when the discussions around Keystone were going on, nobody would actually say this oil will stay in North America. It was heading down to the south, down to the ports, and could just as likely have been put on ships and sold to the highest bidder elsewhere. So if we're saying energy independence, what you're saying is state control over the energy sector, which is antipathy. You know, it's completely against what the Republican Party says it wants to do in terms of its relationship with free enterprise. So unless the Republican Party has suddenly changed and is going towards state control over major sectors through regulations, then I don't understand their logic around energy self-sufficiency.
And Canada, of course, with its conservative leader now, are fully invested in Keystone, but they're also thinking about putting a pipeline through the First Nations territory across to the coast north of Vancouver to export the tar sands oils to China, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. And I have to say that, you know, this is controversial within Aboriginal communities in Canada. Some are very keen to start doing business with China. Some see it as a way of development for their communities. Others have some very serious concerns. And China knows that, and a few years ago brought over a couple dozen Canadian Aboriginal leaders to China to basically say, we want to be your friends. And they came back, the Canadian Aboriginal leaders came back quite entranced with what was on offer to them from China. So it's a very complicated situation in terms of where allegiances are because, you know, Canadian Aboriginal leaders have quite rightly some serious concerns about their relationship with the federal government of Canada and would like to have more independence of action. But at the same time, other groups are very aware of what this could do to their communities environmentally. So it's a real mess, very complicated mess. And it's not happening in isolation. It's happening within the context of larger geoeconomic and geopolitical shifts that are seeing echoes all over the world. What's happening with Aboriginal communities and China and Canada is also happening in the South Pacific and also happening, as I mentioned, in Greenland.
So just back to the effects of global warming impacting the Northeast and New York and New Jersey following this latest storm, And with the Business Week's cover carrying the logo, "It's global warming, stupid." And we keep talking about all of the hideous things that are going to happen to the planet and its people, some of it unimaginable in terms of chaos and dislocation and death. And once the Earth is flooded, it's not going to come back. So what do you think is going to reverse this trajectory of, you know, we're talking about exploiting the geopolitical and geostrategic changes to the Earth, but we're not, you know, the focus should be, of course, as we mentioned earlier, on stopping this catastrophe from happening. What do you think it's going to take if indeed we are going to wake up?
Well, the mindset that's producing this sort of approach towards environmental change in the West is very similar to the mindset that produced the financial crisis, and that is having a difficulty dealing with a rising China. Our political debate and economic debate has, in the West, has increasingly become about short-term profit and looking at the world in terms of resources, you know, and those resources specifically in terms of commodities. Everything's a commodity. Other parts of the world look at things like food, for example, not as a commodity, but as a strategic asset. So Russia doesn't look at a bushel of wheat and think, okay, that's worth, you know, whatever amount on international market. They look at that bushel of wheat and see that's domestic security for the population, which means less likely chance of political uprising. So as long as we look at the world in a short-term perspective and from a commodities perspective, we are going to make short-term decisions based on very narrow economic considerations. The rest of the world, many parts of the rest of the world, are already making the shift towards a longer-term view that looks at things as at least strategic assets. So that creates an entirely different dynamic when they're making decisions around how to interact with their environment. A very small example is China's one-child policy. I do not condone it. I think it's horrific. I'm just using it as an indication of the mindset. They made a decision about 30 years ago to limit most Chinese couples to one child. That was a resource-based decision. They took a look at their resources and they said, we don't have enough resources to feed a growing population. We will reduce our population. Now, if they reduced demand domestically so brutally, you can be sure they're going out to secure supply just as aggressively. We have not taken any sort of long-term assessment that approaches that level of kind of understanding of the finite capacity of the planet in multiple sectors. I'm not condoning a one-child solution. I'm just saying that it's an indication of how some countries are reacting very differently than we are. And ideally, we would come up with a much more humane solution that doesn't involve, you know, forced sterilizations, for example. But that is in compliance with the realities of what the planet has to offer.
Well, Claire Pascal, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Claire Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And her latest book is Global Warming: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.